from KQED.
And we're going to turn now to another topic for the rest of our hour, an interesting topic that's been much in the news over the last couple of weeks, and that has to do with the topic of home genetic testing. Two recent developments have brought this topic back into the news. Last week, Walgreens announced that it would make home genetic test kits available, but the FDA quickly raised concerns about that, and Walgreens backed away. This week, the House Energy and Commerce Committee sent letters out to three home genetic testing companies saying it wanted to investigate questions surrounding the home testing field. So those developments, along with a plan to have incoming freshmen at UC Berkeley voluntarily submit genetic samples as part of a broader campus project, all raise questions about this idea of direct consumer access to genetic information. Does it provide consumers with useful information, or does it potentially mislead consumers by letting them think that they know more than they really do know? We're going to take up this now with Thomas Goetz. He's executive editor of Wired magazine and the author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. Thomas Goetz, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks for being with us. Marcy Darnofsky joins us as well. She's the associate executive editor of the Center for Genetics and Society, a nonprofit organization which looks into the implications of human genetics technologies. Marcy Darnofsky, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Dave.
And Dr. Esteban Burchard joins us as well, associate professor of medicine and biopharmaceutical sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. Good morning.
Thank you.
Happy to have all of you join us. Dr. Burchard, if you would first, tell us what these tests are. What do they allow someone to learn?
Well, there's no simple answer because there's lots of different types of tests, and that's where some of the confusion comes into play. There are tests that specifically test individuals for disease genes or genes that may influence metabolism. In the case of the UC Berkeley, it was to lactose, folate, and alcohol. But then there are several tests that test for genetic ancestry. So what is your racial background, so to speak? Within each of those, disease genes and metabolism and ancestry, there are lots of different types of tests. So for starters, I think there's a lot of confusion out there. But on the flip side, this is a wave of science that is coming. In fact, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is initiating and mandating that physicians and pharmacists know about these tests, and they're holding physicians and pharmacists liable. So I think it's incumbent upon us as a scientific community to make sure that we have solid education at all levels.
And some of what you can find out about this is whether or not you have a gene that might put you at risk, right? It doesn't tell you definitively, but it would tell you if I've got this particular gene mutation, that means my odds increase of having a particular problem, right?
That's exactly right. And there's some genes that are clearly defined and well-tested, and it's very important that we know about those genetic risks. So, for example, there's a disease gene called that's associated with a drug called carbamazepine, which is first-line drug for seizure disorders. If you take that drug and you happen to be Asian, which in which there's a higher risk of the mutation that causes an adverse drug reaction, you have a 1,000-fold increased risk of having a life-threatening reaction. And that's one of the black box warnings that the FDA has required all physicians and all pharmacists to know about. But then there are many other genes that have not been tested, and there are oftentimes a lot of those genes are included in these home kits.
And so these tests can tell us something about the likelihood of whether or not you might get a disease someday, but also whether or not a particular drug would not work well with your particular genetic makeup. Thomas Goetz, you're someone who's argued on behalf of this. Your belief is that more information is good. Walk us through why you think having being able to buy these kits, whether it's at Walgreens or online or anyone else, is more useful than not.
Well, so my argument is that this is basically information. So the DNA that we're getting at, regardless of the technology that Dr. Burchard explained, there are all sorts of different technologies, different tests that are basically unfolding what significance of our DNA, right? And that is 6 billion bits of code in each of us that informs who we are. And basically, that's information about us, just as our hair color, our eye color. We can see that, right? I know what color your hair is. I don't know what your DNA is, but based on a simple test, I can find out that information. my feeling is, and the feeling of a lot of people, is that this information is not something that we need or should require a doctor or some kind of expert class to intermediate for us. We should be able to get access to this information, and based on various services that help us understand the information, integrate that information into our lives, help it inform better decisions, so we can actually take some charge of our lives and understand what the implications are for DNA. Factually, you know, most doctors are not trained in genetics. They aren't necessarily skilled in genetic kind of explication anyway. So it's not necessarily a solution to put doctors in between that process.
And Marcy Darnofsky, what gives you pause about this? If you follow this idea that, as Thomas was setting out, that more information is useful, allows you to know more about what's going on inside your body, what's the problem with that?
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of problems, unfortunately. And, you know, I was struck listening to Professor Shakin and Rachel Miro and you talking about the green cars. There's right ways to do technology and there are wrong ways to do technology. And timing is important as well. I think we are far too early to be putting these products, these gene tests out in drugstores or online and having people believe that the information they get is useful. Not only is it often less than useful, it can actually be quite harmful to be doing this.
Give me an example of what's harmful about taking a home genetics test.
I think we have to be really concerned about genetic privacy. These are startup companies. We can't have 100% confidence that our genetic information is going to be held confidential. Companies go bankrupt. These are small enterprises often. I think we also have to really be aware of how early we are in knowing what these genes do. And the fact that there's such a low barrier to market entry here, combined with the patchy at best, really grossly inadequate oversight and scrutiny by anybody who does know what this information means, we're seeing lots and lots of clearly exaggerated, misleading, inaccurate claims. So, you know, there's questions about whether the labs that are doing the tests, are they even testing accurately for the genes that the genetic variations that they say they're testing for? More important, what does it mean? If they find the genetic variant accurately, what is called the clinical validity of that? Does it mean what they say it does? Sometimes maybe. Many times not.
Well, there are two issues you've raised. Let's sort of drill down on each of them. One is accuracy, and the other is ambiguity. So Professor Burchard, on the first point, I mean, do we know that are these tests accurate?
Yes. Many of the tests are performed in what are called CLIA-certified laboratories, in which the United States government has mandated all laboratories, whether they be a laboratory in a clinical, laboratory in a hospital, or one of these direct-to-consumer companies require and follow standard U.S. guidelines for laboratory standards. So that's off the table. As far as discrimination, the United States passed the GINA. Several countries in the world have passed GINA, which is a Genetic Non-Discrimination Act. So that's off the table.
And just to specify a bit more what that means that employers cannot require you to take a genetic test. It also means that insurance companies can't require you to take a genetic test.
Or act on if they can't take the information and act on it.
Yes. Okay. So we're protected in that way.
In a limited way.
You know, what Dr. Darnofsky says, there's some truth to this too, in that there are different types of tests. In fact, in many religious groups, we mandate that they get premarital testing because certain disease genes are at a higher frequency in different ethnic groups. What's also important, though, and what she said is correct, is that many of the tests are not really developed in other populations. So they may have been identified, say, in Caucasians, but we have no clue as to how they would work in African Americans or Asians.
So that gets to this question, Thomas Getz, of ambiguity, because if we accept what Professor Burchard is saying, that we can count on the fact that these tests are valid, we can't count necessarily, though, on whether or not they're going to give us great clarity, because it might be that it works one way in one population and not in another.
Right.
And even if I have this gene that tells me I have a higher likelihood, it doesn't tell me that anything that will happen necessarily definitively. So
right.
It gives you information. It doesn't give you necessarily clarity.
Right. And my answer to that is 'twas ever thus in science. I mean, that is the way science happens. It's a gradual increase in aggregation of knowledge. We never know everything. We don't know everything about heart disease. We don't know everything about cancer. Mm-hmm. There is all sorts of information that we don't know about health and medicine. The point is, at what point is that information, can the starting points of information, at what point can that help us inform our choices, our decisions, and our actions?
It sounds like, in a sense, you really think that we ought to trust patients more, that we should say, listen, we're grown-ups here. We can figure this out. We don't need everything to be absolute before information is useful.
Absolutely. I mean, it's pretty well demonstrated that actually the fear of people getting this information and making poor decisions, they've actually done a very thorough study of this at Boston University called the REVEAL study, which shows that when people were given the results of a genetic mutation that gave them a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease, for which there is pretty much no treatment and no cure, people didn't freak out. They didn't quit their jobs. They didn't get divorces. They integrated the information into their lives, and they were able to successfully act on that information. It was not life changing in many ways.
Marcy Darnowski, come back on that point.
You know, I think it's hard to have it both ways. Is this going to change everything, or is this going to change nothing? I think if you take a test and you get misleading information, and there are many tests out there that make ridiculous claims about that they're going to find your genetic propensity to shyness or to things that really are – and some of them are actually ethically quite questionable, like the company that is selling to parents the test to see whether their children are better off going into one kind of sport or another kind of sport.
Let's separate that up for a moment, and we'll come back to that, because that does obviously raise a lot of other questions. But what Thomas Goetz is talking about is, let's say you take a test and you get the results and it says, you know what, you've got a higher likelihood of Alzheimer's. Mr. Goetz's point is that people can deal with that. They can deal with ambiguity.
I think people can deal with ambiguity, but I think what people have a hard time understandably dealing with is information that is misleading, advertising claims that are misleading. And I think there are good reasons that we as a society have decided that we're going to license doctors and that we're going to have a government agency that makes sure that we're not having contaminants in our food or things that are going to harm us rather than help us in our medicines.
So sort this out for us, if you can, Professor Burchard, on where ambiguity is useful and where, as Marcy Darnowski is suggesting, these tests open up a window into things that we don't really know, a gene for shyness or whatever. Is that where we really have to be careful on what these tests can tell us and what they can't?
I think both the speakers have very valid points and are correct. What Dr. Darnowski is talking about is genes that are clinically irrelevant. And we know that we don't necessarily believe in biologic determinism and that if you have a particular gene that you're going to grow up to be shy. That is not unlikely to happen. But we know that if you carry the Alzheimer's gene, you will have a high risk of developing Alzheimer's if you're, say, Caucasian or Asian, for example. So
it's sort of classic buyer beware stuff, right?
Well,
I mean, pay attention to what you're being tested for?
It is buyer beware, yes. The real question that we have to understand is the clinical utility and how risk should be conveyed to patients. Yeah. So much in the same way that insurance companies make a generalization about all males under 21, they would have a higher risk, so to speak, than females under 21.
It's a key question, and we'll come back to that when we return. What do you do with this information? Does it prompt you to act in a particular way that might be good or might take you down a road that isn't necessarily useful? That's the question we'll take up when we return. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this, too. What do you think of the idea of home genetic testing? Have you taken such a test? What did it prompt you to do, one way or the other? We'd like to hear your views on this, too. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, back with more in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, genetic testing. How directly should consumers have access to those sorts of tests? Is it okay to just take a test and learn what's going on inside? Or should there be some sort of required medical guidance and counseling in order to give you a more rounded or nuanced picture of what that information is? That's our topic this hour. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this, too. Have you taken a test? What has it told you? How did you react to it? Be curious to hear your points of view. Here are the numbers. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Forum at KQED.org is the email address, or you can go online at kqed.org/forum and put in your comments there. We'll get those on the air. Before we get to our callers, I just want to pick up on the point that Esteban Burchard was making before the break, which is this question of what do you do with the information, which seems like the key question, Marcy Darnofsky. Is that your real concern, that someone will get a test result and say, oh my God, this is what this tells me, I'm going to go out and do this, when that really might not be necessary?
Well, I think there is the question, is this really a technology that empowers people, or is this a technology that endangers people, both as individuals in terms of what kind of decision they might make about something to do or not do, but also as a society? You know, if we start, which we are already doing far too much, overestimating the importance of genes, I think it's all too likely that we're going to be underestimating the importance of social factors and environmental factors, and we're going to get in a lot of trouble that way.
Interesting point. Thomas Katz.
Well, I think, you know, we have a huge problem in this country with our health, right? We have obesity in rate of 35%. If you include people who are overweight, we're at 70%. The fact is we're not communicating health information very effectively in this country. My feeling is that genetic information is a way to give people a head start on thinking about their health. It's not essential. We don't need to know our genetic information, but it's available to us, and it is information, and it can inform our decisions in life. It can help us make better decisions about our health as it interplays with environment, as it interplays with what we eat, how much exercise we get, and we're starting to understand those connections.
But what about the issue of interpretation, I guess? You said earlier that you didn't think MDs were necessarily expert in genetics, fair enough. But wouldn't it be useful when you get this information to have someone walk you through it, to sort of give
Absolutely.
You a kind of ABCs of what it really means?
Absolutely. And you know, Dr. Darnofsky was talking about can we trust the sources? And I think that's something we need to determine. Just as there's all sorts of medical information online that, you know, we go to the internet and we need to decide. It's actually quite overwhelming sometimes. How do we decide what is good information, what is valid information? Those are choices that we make already in ordinary life, right? We decide whether or not we're going to trust the National Enquirer versus we're going to trust the New York Times. Those are two different sources of information, and they have different amounts of validity. We are capable of determining kind of how much we want to trust these sources. Same thing with genetic testing services. Some of them are incredibly scrupulous. They have diligent privacy policies. They're incredibly protective and go to great lengths and have huge, very esteemed scientific advisory boards that help them transform this information, this very kind of technical information, into relevant information for people. But then there are other fly-by-night operations, and people need to be making informed consumer choices just as we do in every other aspect of our lives.
I want to get to the UC story, which is fascinating, but let's slip in a couple of calls quickly, and then we'll come back to what the University of California is doing, which is inviting all incoming freshmen to submit genetic samples. We'll get to the significance of that in a moment, but I don't want to ignore our callers. So let's get a couple of calls in first, and then we'll come back to the UC story. Nancy in Palo Alto has our first observation. Nancy, go ahead, please.
Yes, I find the conversation interesting, and I wanted to share something where you were talking about the applicability of these tests. My husband participated in a study where you did the saliva test, and it was done by a group called 23andMe. And when the results came back, it said that he had a tendency towards colon cancer and bladder cancer. And what was interesting was he had actually had both of those cancers. And so the results allowed us to notify our children that there could be a possibility, and we encouraged them to get tested. So I think that there's a tremendous benefit to having this kind of testing.
Nancy, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Esteban Burchard.
Okay. So a couple of things. I think if you ask all physicians in the world. They'll tell you that the strongest predictors of risk, health risk, are socioeconomic status and lifestyle. So we're not saying that it's all about genetics. But getting back to Mr. Goetz's point about giving information to people, this is just like the AIDS, HIV revolution, when individual patients were going on the internet and knew much more about their medications and disease than physicians. What it calls for, really, is that we need to revamp medical education, not only for physicians, but for pharmacists, and even medical geneticists, because the type of genetics that we're talking about is not the traditional old genetics that it was taught and given to genetic counselors. And in fact, there are many schools out there, Johns Hopkins, one of them, UCSF is one of them, that are really taking the lead to revamp medical education. In fact, I teach 122 first-year pharmacy students every year on the pros and cons about direct-to-consumer marketing, the validity of genetic testing, and the snake oil component of genetic testing.
Is the key point in some of this, as our caller suggested, that in their family case that allowed them to point to their kids, that they really ought to think about this? But the key word there is think about this, right? It doesn't necessarily mean go out and do X or do Y. It's part of an overall equation. Your genetic makeup is part of it. But as the old saying goes, you know, genetics may load the gun, but a lot of other things, including the environment, pull the trigger. So it's only one part of the equation.
Exactly.
Let's take another caller, and we'll go to Jesse next in Marin. Jesse, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 27 now. I was diagnosed with melanoma when I was 25 year and a half ago. And I had a genetic test at UCSF. I was tested for BRCA1 and 2, which is the melanoma, breast cancer, and ovarian cancer gene. And I found that having a genetic tester at my disposal really helped me through the process, because if I had had the gene, I would have had to have my ovaries out at 35, which is pretty big deal given how young I am and big life decisions. So I worry about these home genetic testing, not having those resources available to you with genetic testers being able to help you through the process and the psychological challenges given your results.
Jesse, thanks. Again, this question, Thomas Goetz and then Marcy Darnofsky, of ambiguity, that information is part of the equation, but interpretation and coming to terms with what decision is appropriate is a whole other aspect of this.
Yeah, I think the fact that, you know, that genetics start to get us to think about kind of a sequence of choices that we're going to have to be making. So as Dr. Bouchard said, you know, the idea that that genetics is kind of fate, right? It's the hand of fate, and kind of we're getting a look inside the crystal ball. That's actually not the way most genetics work. Most of it is just kind of pointing us towards certain directions, and we have the opportunity to take other directions that either can minimize our risks, minimize our genetic risks, or we can take early actions to kind of take advantage of that information. In the case of a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, those are kind of very serious and grave choices oftentimes. Women are faced with the idea of getting their ovaries removed, as this caller was talking about, getting their breasts removed. But the idea that we can actually know about that and take those actions before a cancer happens, those are actually good opportunities.
Marcy Darnofsky, you want to add something on this question?
You know, those are not the kind of decisions. What both of the callers raised are decisions that I think they would be very ill-advised to take without talking to probably more than one doctor. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why you have major medical associations, including the American Society for Human Genetics, the AMA, the American Clinical Laboratory Association, all of whom have come out with statements raising very serious concerns about these do-it-yourself tests.
But wouldn't we expect those people to come in and defend their own interests? I mean, I think the fact is, I'm not saying that people should do DIY medicine. I don't think that this is
meaning do-it-yourself.
Do-it-yourself medicine. That isn't the case at all. I just don't think that we need to require doctors to be our intermediaries. This is information about ourselves.
You know, both Mr. Goetz and Dr. Bouchard have said that there's a lot of room for errors in interpretation, mm-hmm. and that there's a lot of snake oil out there. So at the very least, I think we need the kind of oversight and public policy in place that will protect rather than endanger consumers and patients.
Before we get to our next call, let me bring up this thing that I've hinted at but haven't fully allowed us to converse about more fully, which is what the University of California, Berkeley is doing, which is fascinating. They're inviting students on a voluntary and confidential basis to submit a DNA sample, which would give yield information about their ability to metabolize alcohol, dairy products, and leafy green vegetables. And they're doing it as part of this larger project, Thomas Goetz, which is to spark a conversation about where we're at in personalized medicine these days. They're going to have lectures about it and broader campus discussion groups. What do you make of this idea that as an incoming freshman, you would submit your DNA? Does that give you pause at all?
It actually, I think it's a wonderful experiment. I think they got the PR a little bit wrong. They seem not to have actually explained the process thoroughly enough, and then the kind of media got ahead of them, and there was a lot of rumors and fear about what was going to get tested that actually don't reflect what the actual experiment was proposing to do. And I think that's one of the problems, right? I mean, one of the problems that we have is that as a society, we feel like genetics is scary. Mm-hmm. When the word DNA comes up, we get scared and we think it's something that is somehow going to reveal bad things. And the fact is, you know, we already talk about DNA. When we talk about family history, we're talking about oftentimes DNA. When we talk about all sorts of things about ourselves that has genetic roots. But we need to be more comfortable with this idea, and it's going to be a process.
Arthur Kaplan, the medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, said, this is a bad precedent to set up mass testing without counseling support. What do you think, Esteban Bouchard?
It's not that black and white. What I can say, and I feel strongly about, is that the genetic revolution is here. And we collectively, whether we like it or not, it's coming. And we need to collectively learn how to deal with it. It's not left or right. There's a common ground. And I think it's going to require sincere dialogue, ethical oversight, and re-education.
And should that be mandatory? I mean, part of what's sort of raised eyebrows about the UC Berkeley idea is that there doesn't seem to be – maybe there is, and someone can correct us and call in about this – but a complementary counseling program so that students, if they learn they're lactose intolerant or they can't process alcohol or whatever, don't necessarily – it won't be built in that they have some interpretation of those results.
But they do have medical services at the university. They do have alcohol counseling services available at the university.
And you're saying it's up to them. It shouldn't be mandatory.
It's completely voluntary whether students want to join it. And it isn't like they're just getting this information and they're cast on their own.
Marcy Darnofsky, quickly, and we'll go back to our
voluntary
class.
Voluntary technically, but when your university says we want everyone in the incoming class to take this test – that's an abuse of authority that I think students should be able to put in their university. I'm afraid that this is serving actually as a promotion of this whole direct-to-consumer industry that's springing up. I don't think the university should be doing that.
But it's anonymous.
It is anonymous, and
yes.
It is, and there is
– these are genes that don't carry high clinical risk. It's not like testing the BRCA gene. Lactose intolerance affects – millions of people.
But it's normalizing an acceptance of these do-it-yourself tests, and that's what's so controversial.
Well,
that's the controversy here.
I don't know. I don't think there's any evidence that this is a conspiracy on the part of the university to kind of kowtow to these consumers. I think what they're giving is the students an opportunity to get a worldview ahead of the rest of the world. They're on the vanguard of the way, as Dr. Bouchard is going to say, saying this is the way the world is going. Yeah. And thank God these university students are getting this dialogue and this debate now.
A couple of emails coming in. Corrine writes in, all this information being discussed is good. When I have to receive results from medical tests, I'd much rather have access to information online to give me a more balanced and additional facts and opinions. MDs and other professionals don't have the time to adequately explain those results. Mm-hmm. George writes in, my wife and I signed up for 23andMe genetic testing. We've been thrilled with it. The testing company gave us information about the test and let us understand how our genetic information might affect our lives. And let's get another caller engaged. Catherine in Palo Alto joins us next. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know that I've been involved in school tests before, and there's no pressure. It's always kind of exciting to get involved in the test before, so I think that's kind of a misnomer. And in the real world, you know, in the ideal world, it would be fabulous to be able to never get in the sun and learn languages at 60 and do all the things possible to be as healthy as possible. But I think these tests will help prioritize. You know, my grandmother had Alzheimer's. Her sister had Alzheimer's. I would love to know if I had that gene, so I would know how to prioritize my time to do things to prevent Alzheimer's.
Catherine, thanks. We're going to let you go because your cell is breaking up. But thanks. We got your point, I think. Thanks for joining our conversation. And Peyton will join our conversation next in San Francisco. Peyton, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. We got tested actually 2 years ago before 23andMe actually was officially launched. We were part of the pre-test phase. And it was a perfect timing because my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But he had a heart condition that required him to take medication that would actually give him the symptoms as if he would have Parkinson's. And the test actually allowed us to identify that he did, in fact, had the gene that allowed him to have it. And then we did the invasive test versus just saying, okay, we will do the invasive test regardless if we know or don't.
Peyton, thank you. Marcy Tarnowski, we're hearing a lot of people say, you know, we'd rather know, and then we'll take it from there. It sounds like people would rather err on the side of having information than not.
But I'm sure people want accurate information and information that's not misleading. And I think that at this point, too many of these tests are just being offered in a very reckless way.
Give me an example of what's being marketed in a reckless way.
Well, for example, we're going to tell you the one I started to refer to before. We're going to tell you whether your toddler has fast twitch or slow twitch muscles. Now, what kind of family dynamics is that going to set up? Should that child really be channeled into a particular sport because of what some gene test said? Or should that child be left to her or his own devices to find out what they want?
She's absolutely correct. And, you know, we call that recreational genomics or snake oil. But in several cases, there are very valid genetic tests. And as I mentioned, the FDA is mandating these tests despite the fact that many providers, healthcare providers, are not fully educated in how to interpret these tests. And they're leaving it up to patients and they're leaving the medical liability on providers. So it's really important to keep in mind that there's a whole gradient of truly valid genetic test, and there's some snake oil.
Agree completely, and that's why we need oversight, I think, to distinguish between what works and what doesn't.
Well, let's talk about the oversight question, because given those possibilities, the snake oil possibilities, Thomas Goetz, what's wrong with having a little bit more oversight?
So I don't have any problem with the idea that there are kind of certification or kind of an approval process, if you know, a gold star, if you will, but the idea that we need to that consumers need an intermediary, whether it's through doctors or genetic counselors, to get access to this information, I think is not a tenable argument. Donald Berwick, the Obama's nominee to head CMS, the agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, he made a very good point. He said your exceptional cases make for very bad policy. Talking about this possibility of patients kind of acting on medical information and doing kind of things that are to their not to their benefit. I think the fact that we assume that people are not going to be able to process this information. The assumption that because there might be kind of fly-by-night operations that we need to kind of shut down the whole industry, I think that frankly it runs afoul of a lot of the ways we have generally used the free market and other ways of kind of allowing information to filter out and to allow innovation to happen.
Well, how do consumers best make these choices if there is a buyer beware element to this? And you're all seeming to suggest that there are companies that do this well and some companies that really need to be aware of. How do you sort that out? I looked at the Navigenics website, which is one of the companies that the House Committee sent a letter of inquiry to. And there's a claim, here's what it says on their webpage. They say, our goal is to empower you with genetic insights to help motivate you to improve your health. Will a new medication be effective for you? Will a treatment cause serious side effects? Genetic insights from Navigenics can help you. So there's some salesmanship there, wouldn't you say, Esteban Burchard? But it's not sort of claiming the moon.
That's right. And they're very good companies. 23andMe, Navigenics have done a great job of saying what this information provides and clearly what it does not provide. And I think that is left for patient interpretation, and that's where there's a gray area. I've got myself tested, my family tested at many of these companies, and there are fly-by-night companies that are really, really selling snake oil. But I think there are some premier companies that, especially for ancestry testing, people want to know.
And we should note, by the way, Navigenics and 23andMe, both of which we've talked about, are two of the companies that the Congressional Committee is now sending a letter of inquiry to that shouldn't be necessarily interpreted that they are some of those fly-by-night organizations. But they are part of this problem.
I want to state that I'm very happy that this conversation is going on. I could tell you that there's heavy debates about this at Stanford, heavy debates at UC Berkeley, strong debates at UCSF. And so this is something that's bubbling to the surface. And we as a scientific community, as a community at large, are going to have to deal with this sooner or later.
What's your thoughts on sort of advice for consumers, Thomas Goetz? I mean, given this kind of as everyone has said, we're in this world, whether we like it or not. So how do we sort of sort it out?
Well, so my sense is that, you know, as I said earlier, we have a real health crisis in this country. People aren't doing enough for their health. If genetic information from a reputable company will help them start to feel empowered and feel a sense that they can actually start making better decisions for their health, I think that's something that we should absolutely be in favor of. I'm not saying that we have to do that. I think you know, if you go all the way to having a heart attack and that's when you decide to take your health seriously, by all means, take your health seriously. But whatever it is, whatever the triggers are, we need to find a way to help people get better information and to act on that information. And I think genetics is absolutely a part of that.
Thomas Goetz is the editor of Wired magazine and author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. We've also heard from Esteban Burchard, Associate Professor of Medicine and Biopharmaceutical Sciences at UCSF, and Marcy Dornofsky, the Associate Executive Editor, Director, rather, of the Center for Genetics and Society. As you know, this is also Pledge Week on KQED Public Radio, a time when we do ask our listeners for our support, for your support. And if you'd like to be engaged in that, just go to kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. And let's take another caller at this time. Daniel joins us next from Larkspur. Daniel, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm a recent graduate at UC Davis, and I took a class in nutritional genomics. And we learned about how your diet can interact with your genes on an epigenetic level and how different diets will help myself in one way and someone else differently depending on our genetics. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about how that might play into these home tests on both sides, whether food companies might start targeting their products along genetic lines, and then the importance of knowing whether your diet is really as healthy as you think it is based on your genetics.
Daniel, thanks. Fascinating question. Esteban Burchard, do you want to take that?
Fortuitously, I just happened to spend a week with one of my colleagues who has severe food allergies, and she gave me a whole week of information about how her family history was a risk factor for foods that she ate and that we needed to all be mindful of it. The science is not advanced enough, though. Mm-hmm. To take it to an individual level to say, if you have this gene,
you shouldn't eat X.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And as part of your concern also, Marcy Dornofsky, what the caller was suggesting, that this sort of opens up a whole new possibility for marketing?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you've got companies that are testing you for the skin wrinkling gene and then selling you expensive hundreds of dollars products to fix it. So, yeah, we're opening ourselves up to a lot of marketing issues and the health information. Yeah, we need health information, but we don't need bad information, and we don't need companies pushing on us products that may be bad for our health.
But as Thomas Goetz suggests, isn't that true in all avenues of our life? That's
yes,
part of what being an educated
yes,
consumer
is.
Involves.
And the FTC,
absolutely.
The FTC is actually there to make sure that misleading consumer claims
and
aren't
and needs
there.
To do more than they've done. They've raised alarms, but they have taken not one direct action against any of these bad claims, exaggerated, misleading, inaccurate claims to date.
Let's get another caller. Nancy in Sunnyvale joins us next. Nancy, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to recommend sincerely that this be mandatory medical education. I was recently diagnosed with a very rare autoimmune condition, and some graduate student decided to make a paper out of it and run my DNA to see if they couldn't do a link. they found during that process that I lacked the gene that was necessary to metabolize the chemotherapy they were going to put me on, and about 2 days before I was supposed to begin, they let me know that had I taken that drug, I would have died, and subsequently got a better chemotherapy, and I'm fine now.
That's true.
Nancy, thanks. Thanks for the call. This is a huge area, Esteban Burchard, that we're learning so much more about now, and a lot of work is being done on trying to figure out whether or not specific kinds of treatments for cancer in particular will work or not based on your genetic makeup.
That is absolutely true. And just for the record, all medical students and pharmacy students take genetics. But the question is, we've been taught the old classical genetics that if you have the cystic fibrosis gene, which you're likely to get cystic, you're almost 100% likely to get cystic fibrosis. But what we're talking about is a new era of genetics, and we need more research, and we clearly need more education, not only on the health provider side, but on the public side.
Couple of listener emails. I submitted my DNA to 23andMe. According to the results, I had a high risk for Crohn's disease, which I now know that I do have, and the lowest possible risk for dyslexia, which I actually have, and a significant risk for stroke. So it can tell you a lot of things, and it sounds like a lot of information that has to be processed. Rick writes in San Jose, the issue is not about what it reveals, but that if it reveals anything at all, the idea of providing personal information that we have no control over the ultimate disposition of it is unethical. Perhaps this is anonymous now, but at what point will genetic data be provided that has identifying factors that may become available to others? Thomas Guest, how do you deal with the privacy issue?
So it's a very real issue, but I think it's important to know that, first of all, that we can't guarantee privacy in any form, in any means, right? So genetics is a piece of information that people feel very personal about, but really there's nothing to do about it. I mean, you know, if I take your social security number, I can do all sorts of things with that number. I can open bank accounts. I can do all sorts of things. I can't do anything with your genome. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing I can do to exploit it. The George Church at Harvard University has a very good policy on this. When he runs the Personal Genome Project, which is trying to get 100,000 people to sequence their genome and to create a huge database. And the 100,000 people are not being promised privacy. What they're being promised is that this organization will do their utmost to maintain as much confidentiality as possible. But the acknowledgement is that it's impossible to actually absolutely guarantee privacy. And I think it's important to explain that to consumers.
We have to go, but I bet that's not good enough for you, Marcy Darnofsky.
Well, to just shrug and say, get over it. We don't have any more privacy. I don't think that's a good answer.
We'll have to leave it there. Marcy Darnofsky of the Center for Genetics and Society. Thomas Guest of Wired Magazine and author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine, and Esteban Burchard, Associate Professor of Medicine and Biopharmaceutical Sciences at UCSF. Thanks all very much for being part of our conversation.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.